about 1939 or 1940 along in there. It was my first time of show.
Mary Lennon.
Mary Lennon and a girl by the name of Rogoski. It was the two that was picked up with these colored fellas. Incidentally, one of the colored fellas' wife was up at the hospital having a baby right at the very time. And they didn't know where he was. He was out tearing around someplace, and the police picked him up and had him up there when they, that course is...
What were they charged with?
Oh, dissociation and the usual things that went along, you know. They were just looking at the moon. studying the weather and
was
a few
this
things.
At the police station or at the
but,
jail?
The minute these colored people here heard about that, why, they were awful touchy. They started right off forming mobs, and they armed themselves down in Johnstown and barricaded their doors and out on the west side, and it got wild as could be. And they at that time, I only had one deputy and two bailiffs that worked as deputies, and the three or four of us was trying to handle the mess. Well, I had these fellows in jail, and they started to gang up the street outside, you know, and...
White folk?
Yeah, mostly whites out there in the front of the jail. And I went to the door and talked to them and told them to go on home. It was all under control on the deal. The whites was laughing about it. But these colored people were scared stiff, and they're the ones that called Cliff Townsend. Well, Cliff called me. He wanted to know what on earth was going on up there. And I told him about what had happened, and he said, what do you think about it? Is it dangerous? And I said, I don't think so. I don't think it is at all. The whites are just laughing about it. And if these, unless some drunken white and some drunken colored fellow bumps into each other down here and a mill starts, don't think it's dangerous at all. So Cliff said, now I'll tell you what you do. Get those two fellas in a car just as quick as you can and take them to Pendleton. Down to the reformatory, and get whatever help you need for to go down there and take them to Pendleton, and I'll call a warden and make arrangements for them locked up down there. And so I said, all right. So me and the chief of police here at Marion, we sneaked them out the back door, and we started driving towards Wabash. Three or four cars followed us on the way, but... I dodged around and outrun them and took these two fellows down to Pendleton to the reformatory, and I got a receipt for it. I came back to Marion, and I had some copies made of this receipt. John Gormley, my chief deputy, and myself, I went down and went into Johnstown, and John went out on the west side, and we got a hold of these colored people who was in there, you know, and we showed them the receipt, and we told them, now then, don't let anything happen. These boys are safe. They're going to get a fair and square trial. You hold your people down, and we'll hold these whites down. We don't want this thing to ever happen again. You see, Cliff was going to send the National Guard up right then.
What happened to those guys?
Well, we had them down in the reformatory for about a month. Brought them up to Marion one day, and they pleaded guilty, and they gave them a little fine and turned them loose. That's all there was to it. But it had quieted down by that time.
Let me ask you a question. When the mob first went in this jail, they got the wrong guy.
Well,
but then they got the right one, and Smith was downstairs in a lower cell with some other people. And he had hid up behind something that let the doors open. Do you know what they're talking about there? Do you remember that at all?
Well, there was doors in the corridor in there. There was on each floor it could be locked off, but then there was a big
He climbed up. He climbed up in the ceiling some way to hide.
Oh, he didn't. He couldn't have got into the ceiling, but he could have got up on top of a swinging door. Because this door had a semicircle of rods, and the top and the bottom is real heavy, and it would swing open, you know, like this, and there was about 18 inches of room above the top of that door. I had a fellow one time who tried to bean me with a bunch of faucet. He'd taken a penny and taken the tops off of faucets and strung them on a shoestring, you know. And he was laying on top of the door, and his pal in there threw a fit, and she started yelling, and raising the dickens, and the turnkey came running over to the house for me to come over. Right away, there was something was wrong back in there, you know, and this pal of this fellow's that was laying over the door, he was... just turning the somersets around and holding himself and going on like he's about to die. And the turnkey unlocked the door and gave it a push, and I walked in, and the man with the shoestring, he come down like this, and the shoestring broke, and those handles off of the faucets flew all over everywhere, or I'd have got my head knocked off. I remember that pretty well, too. But we got him down. He just laughed about it. He thought it was funny.
Did you think Spider-like. It was funny? Did you
no,
think it was
I didn't think it was. If I'd have got something for that, about 2 or 3 pound of brass faucet tops in there, but he was up laying on top of that door, the one you was talking about down there. But inside of the jail, or right immediately following it, because they were in and was all over with by the time we got down there. But I do remember well when I was washing the windows over the garage and found that stick of dynamite up there. Found a stick of dynamite with a cap in it laying in an upstairs window. I had some trustees out there washing down the bar. They had to reach through the bars on the outside to wash the windows, you know. One of them called me up there, and here was this stick of dynamite in there, and it had been fused, and it had been lit. It had been lighted, and it burnt back to where the fuse was crimped. You take a dynamite fuse and crimp it, mash it flat or crimp it, you know, and the fire will burn up to that, and it'll go out. Won't do it every time, but it does often enough. And this stick of dynamite had laid out there for all those years. The paper on it had come apart, you know, and all. John Garmley and I took it out to we took it out to the city dump, laid it on an old automobile out there, and shot it all to pieces with a high-power rifle, and we couldn't make it explode. It laid out in the weather.
You think it was left over from this thing in 1930?
Yeah, it was put up there that night. Somebody climbed up on that and was intending to blow a hole in the wall of the jail up above where the garage is in there, you know.
When did you find it?
Oh, after I was in there about 37, 38 long in there. I had the gang out there washing the windows.
And in the summertime?
Yeah, it was summertime. And one of them,
and where was that? On the window of the third floor?
Window of the third floor.
Which side?
Above the jail, on the west side.
West side.
Right above the garage.
Well, how would anybody got up there? Throw it up there or climb up
no,
there?
No, they wouldn't have thrown that dynamite. Somebody give them a push up there somehow. They might have had a ladder. I wouldn't be surprised what they did. But this was laying on the sill of the window up there.
You know, on the outside.
On the outside, yeah. There's a lot of funny things. Well, Cliff was scared plenty of that day when he called me down from Indianapolis. Of course, Townsend and I knew each other well. We'd been right around town here together. They said, you know, we never in the world thought that I would ever be involved in a thing like this. But one of them told me, and he said, I woke up pulling on that rope. But how I got there, I can't tell
you. Yeah, it was a businessman told
one
you
of
that?
One of the big businessmen here in Marion. But he said, I was in there, and I was pulling on that rope to pull those fellows up on the limb there at the courthouse. And I can't for the life of it tell you why or how that happened. Why it was I had a hold of that. He said, it makes me sick when I think of it yet.
He was a reputable guy in the community?
Oh, yes, he was. He was a businessman downtown there.
Is he dead now?
Yeah. But he told me when we were talking over down to jail one time afterwards, told me about being in the thing, and I said, well, were you in it when it started? And he said, no, I just heard there was a mob coming, and I just joined it. That's what the way mobs do. They start out, and somebody wants to see the excitement, and they tag a hold of the thing.
Get caught up in it.
Yeah. There's a sort of a hysteria about a thing of that sort. And people will, under pressure like that, will do things that they would never think of doing by themselves. But a mob's a dangerous thing, a very dangerous thing. It's almost certain that they'll go beyond anything that anyone ever expected them to do. And things can happen under mob control that could never happen any other way. Most of the people that took part in that didn't know what it was all about.
Do you know any other people, or have you ever talked to them who told you that they were in it that weren't never?
Oh, a lot of people kind of like to brag about it on the deal, but there was none of them that some of them had heard all sorts of tales and stories on the deal, but I never yet got a hold of it or remember of talking to anybody that actually led the break into the jail. I know that from what they told me, and they didn't get those hinges sledged off of the jail. You can see yet down there where the show stoneworks all chipped out, where they hammered it out of there. But they didn't get in that way. One of the deputies, somebody said it was the sheriff. I didn't see it. I can't tell you. But someone from the inside of the jail threw the ring of keys out there.
You say one of the deputies told you that?
No, I don't remember who it was. I wouldn't want to say it was one of the deputies, but the man that told me said it was the sheriff, although the turnkey had the ring.
Yeah.
And it normally the turnkey would be the one that had it. We always sprung those keys, or a big key that sprung right now, and then somebody would want to put up a fight, and we'd wrap them to the side of the head with that ring of keys, and that was all that was necessary. Didn't have to worry about them anymore.
So you had a riding bailiff.
And a court bailiff.
And a court bailiff. And then how many deputies?
One. One paid deputy.
And you?
And me.
That's all there was?
That's all there was.
I mean, Jake came away, probably.
And,
Jake came away.
Well, he said he didn't think Jake had any more than he had.
I got $3,280 a year salary.
Well, you had a turnkey in the jail.
I had to pay him myself.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, they didn't. Had to pay him on the profit we made on 20 cents a meal. We had to buy all the food and serve it ourselves. Lucille and had a couple of trustees that worked with her, and they did the cooking. And gasoline, oil, and own their own
cars too.
Furnished their own guns and equipment. They didn't have any such a thing as a uniform. All I had was a badge, and I had to buy them out of my own pocket. We didn't
have. You just wore plain clothes, huh?
Yeah, that was the way it was here. And the turnkey down there was paid by the sheriff out of his own pocket.
You didn't have any radios, did you?
We didn't have any radios.
You used your own car?
Used our own cars. I had three cars and bought my own gasoline, did my own bill.
Did you buy your own cars?
Yeah. And two of them were secondhand ones when I went in, and then we bought one new one. But people don't know, you look at that, and they don't realize that they paid $3,280 a year for a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week job. And that was the way it was. And now, if you want to know why it was, there was so much of this laxness and bootlegging. It was just exactly that. A good, smart sheriff. We never even tried to live on his salary. He could always pick up enough money along the sides, you know, that from here and there, from the good boys that was willing to donate. The sheriff did right well. Almost every one of them but me come out there with a farm. I didn't have anything, only a patch on my pants.
How did Jake do?
I paid the bills, and that's about all, you know. But
How did Jake do? How'd Jake do?
Jake Hammer, well... they say don't talk about the dead.
Did he get a farm?
He was indicted one time before a grand jury. Him and Jack Edwards both were during the bootleg days. They were both indicted. You remember that? But then when the, bootleg law, the liquor law was repealed, their indictment against them was quashed and they was turned loose. But Jake Campbell and Jack Edwards both was indicted on that.
Is this jail still pretty much the same way as it was when
just
you were there?
Just about like. John Gormley and I, used to put on overalls and take pipe wrenches and get in there and fix the plumbing and work the thing over. John was an electrician and I was a sheet metal man and knew something about plumbing, and that's the only thing we could do. And we got it painted now and then by going out and catching a bunch of painters, and the judge would throw the book at them and give them 30 days in jail, and they'd paint the jail rather than sit around and nothing happened. I tell you a funny thing. We had I had 21 mattresses and 23 blankets, and the blankets had been and the mattresses had been treated with fly dope like linoleum, and we just didn't have anything, see, and so I was I had no money. I had about $400 to $500 for the year. You know, they didn't appropriate anything about anything. So I was worrying my head off. We had fellas in there that all we could do was take them in and lay them on the iron slats and they're, you know, drunks and so on, because we simply couldn't. We didn't have anything to go with. And as far as the deputies are concerned, they were the two bailiffs was paid by the two riding bailiffs. The judge kept his court bailiffs, both of them, but the riding bailiffs, they didn't have any use for them. But they were on their payroll, on the judge's payroll. I didn't have any control over it. I only had one man on mine.
Well, let me ask you how this worked. Let's say you had to serve a subpoena.
Yeah.
And you charged a dime for that. Could you charge whatever the cost was, or was there a set base?
You got mileage out and back if you served a paper. But if you went out for the chase on an automobile wreck or anything like that, you didn't get anything towed.
And that came right straight back to you,
I'd
right?
I'd say there was a fight in Gas City or Matthews or someplace like that, and we'd be down to break it up. We didn't get a nickel out of it. Didn't even get the gasoline.
You had to pay for that yourself.
Yeah, I had to pay for it ourselves, and we had to stand our own insurance and everything like that.
Now, your house was right there in the jail, though.
Yeah, we lived in the house. We got that. We lived there in the jail. That was a nice place in there. I was going to tell you about one of the county commissioners. This fellow in here is dead now, and best not to even mention any names, but I went down to... And out in the county where he lived, he's a farmer. I went out there and got a hold of his wife. She said, well, he's plowing out there in the field. If you'll wait just a little bit, when he comes around, why, you can talk to him. So I'd never met him, not this particular man. He was supposed to be one of the bell cows. I say, I hadn't been in there very long at the time. I hadn't met him. And when he came around, I told him who it was, and I told him what we needed. And we needed some help and some money on that jail. I want to know if he'd help us get some money for to straighten, clean up the mess and straighten it out. And I never will forget what he said. He looked at me and he said, well, Trevor, why is it you need all these things? The man who's ahead of you wasn't hollering for help all the time. Why do you have to have all these things? And I told him, well, if this other man had asked for any help, boy, he was getting his another way. He was on a payoff, you know. And if he'd have got it, I wouldn't have needed it. But I've got men in there that I've got to have some blankets, I've got to have mattresses, and I've got to have some way or other to handle them. And this fellow says, well, now you're a young fellow. I was a young fellow then compared to what I am now. And he said, there's lots of things you have to learn. And one of the first is that jail is a place of punishment. I'm not in favor of spending good money on a bunch of drunks to let them lay in their county expense. So let them go dirty and let them go hungry and let them suffer and maybe they won't come back again. Now there was mentality, the psychology of the thing. I said, let them go drunk, let them go dirty and let them go hungry and maybe they won't come back anymore. Now that's one wall down in there. Although that's a good sound building, it's sound yet. I don't give a darn what they say. It's in good condition yet. Not much. But I had, usually the commissioners would appropriate $350 to $500 for repairs on a jail. And the first bill he had down there used it all. And Judge Clausen and Judge Dickey both worked along on this deal. It was kind of funny. I'd get down up against it. I had money and I could buy paint down to Pendleton. You always had to buy your paint through the prison, you know, or anything like that. Everything that they made down there, like brooms and mats and all that stuff, you could get down there at the Pendleton and paint. So I went to go to the judge and say, Judge, look, that jail looks like the devil. It needs to be cleaned and painted up. And I don't have any money, and I don't have any painters. And he said, well, how much money have you got? And I told him, and he said, will that buy the paint? I told him, well, it probably will. And he said, well, now let me see. That was Clausen talking. It seems to me like I have every so often some of our town drunks that I have to send out to the Pendle farm or out to the poor farm out here. And he said, why wouldn't it be just as well for to send them over to the jail? And he said, they might make good painters. And so we'd go out here and round up these bunch of drunks, and we'd tip the judge off. The judge had given 30 days in jail or 60 days in jail, you know. We got the jail painted. There's lots of that stuff in there.
Louis Lenneman?
Lennon
Muth.
The peculiar thing of it is that the average person in those days had paid just as little attention to law enforcement as anything. It just didn't mean anything. There's men that in all their lives had never stepped a foot inside of the jail. The only time they was ever in the courthouse was when it was whether to pay their taxes or something like that, you know, and they had no more conception of what went on than nothing. And you couldn't interest them in it. The only thing they were looking at, how much it's going to cost.
He was asking me, did you know Louis Linnemuth?
Yeah, Louis Linnemuth, he was chief of police at one time here.
Did you know him?
Yeah.
What kind of guy was he?
Pretty nice sort of a fellow. I always got along all right with Lou. I think he was captain at the night of this hanging, if I remember right. I think he was a police captain.
He's chief.
Was he chief at the time? I guess that's right. That's right. I've forgotten. Yeah, I knew Lou. I worked along with him. Okay. Lou would give me a lot of tips on that. You'll see, I was just green and grass. I didn't know any more about law than a Hulk knows about war. I had no more conception of what I should have done than nothing. All I did, I knew I got elected, and that was it.
Did you have any markings on your cars or anything that said you were the sheriff?
The red lights was all. It was our own private cars and all, and we had a red light and siren, and that was all.
Now, were those closed, or were they curtain-sided in those days?
What you mean, the cars?
Yeah.
They were a closed car. 35 Plymouth, and I got it from the police department. Brannon was chief of police at the time, and I had to buy a car, and old Frank came over there. I knew him pretty well, and he came over and he said, look, you've got to have some cars when you went on that sheriff's job. I'll tip you off to something. The police department's trading a 1935 car in down at Charlie Stokes' place. Agency, and he said, now that car has had all new rubber on, and it's all been overhauled all the way through, and it's got a lot of good miles in it. And if you hurry right down to old Charlie, you can buy that car cheap. Said, you go down there and tell him I sent you. So I said, well, why are you fellows want to get rid of it? And he said, well, it doesn't have a trunk on the back. We have a tip, we're going to get radios some of these times, we hope to. And we won't have any place to put a radio in it, so we want to get something else.
You know what you paid for it?
What I paid for it? I think if I remember right, it was $400.